Hello, welcome to another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. Jeff, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing wonderful. Sal, yourself?
Doing awesome. Doing awesome. Wonderful.
Who you got for us today?
What a crowd favorite.
Oh, a crowd favorite.
He's got a following. Our only podcast guest that has his own groupies.
Cool.
They're probably out in the lobby right now.
You know, we haven't seen them show up here yet. But
can you tell my wife that?
Yeah, Donna would love that. Glenn Longaball, our technical agronomist at Premier Ag, and he has been busy the last few days and with grower meetings. But before we get into all that, the question of the day, Glenn, and this would be interesting. I might have to seed mine just to get a second or third one of yours.
Sure.
What is the weirdest do-it-yourself project that you've ever attempted or started?
Yeah, so I didn't read this till this morning, and
us either.
And I was just like, you know, oh, I don't know. You know, I've had lots of, you know, DIYs when I was younger. Was that a necessity? Because you couldn't afford to have somebody that was competent to do it, right? And lots of failures. As I get older, what I've discovered is that I'm much more reluctant to start something DIY unless I've got everything figured out, right? But probably my most infamous DIY is, you know, that I'm an avid hunter. Right? Mm-hmm. I love to bow hunt. And when I was younger, I tried to go every year. And the only way that I could really afford to go out west or, you know, go to, you know, some of these really remote locations was to do it yourself, backpack bow hunts. Right. And so, even though I've got a great group of hunting buddies, oftentimes they would they kind of check up on me when you're talking about picking up camp and going to look in the next drainage. Because you know how it works, Jeff. if this place is good, if we just go one more ridge in, it's got to be better, right? Because, you know, just the fact that all the topographic lines are so close together that they look like they're solid, right? That means it's really steep.
Yeah, those big bulls are always just a little bit higher.
I am just sure that the next drainage is going to hold a giant, right? Or they're going to be one behind every tree. Well, you know, I got to where these things became so epic. You know, so epic that a lot of folks got to where they, you know, they didn't really want to participate. And I thought, boy, it'd be nice if I had access to pack animals. But pack animals really take a lot away from a hunt because now you got to care for critters in addition to. Well, a mutual friend of ours, by the first name of Jerry, we'll leave him nameless. But
sorry, Jerry.
He raises, right? He's from Davies County, and he raises a French dairy breed of goat called Oberhalsleys, right? So now you know exactly who I'm talking about. He had told me that there are people using goats as pack animals.
I'm
thinking, oh my gosh, this is going to work, right? I don't have to have a trailer. They're very easy keepers. You know, he got these animals back pretty regularly, right? Because, you know, people get goats for 4-H projects. Well, when you get done with them, if it's a doe, you know, you can milk a doe. The fate of a wether, right, which is a castrated buck, is what?
Going to the locker point.
Yeah, slaughter. Well, most 4-H kids don't really want to slaughter their project, and yet the parents don't want them. So, you know, he's always got these leftover weathers, and I thought, well, this is great.
Broke the lead?
Yeah, I can break them to follow me around.
And you're going to take them out west as a pack mule.
Exactly, right? And the thing is, they have this ability to carry a really high percentage, right? So can a horse carry more than a mule? They can, but per unit body weight, it's less, right? And can a donkey carry more than a mule? No, but they can carry a higher percentage mass, right? Llamas, the same way, right? They're smaller. They can't carry as much, but of their body mass, they can carry more. And goats can carry almost their entire body weight, right? As pack animal, I thought, this is going to be great. I got these goats. We turned them loose on the bluff. Yeah, I've probably withheld this intentionally. And by the way, I found out something about goats, right? They have this reputation for eating everything, not French dairy goats, right? They are very particular about what they eat. They're not browsers, right?
So you took these goats out west?
So I let's not get ahead of ourselves. It's going to take a minute. Okay. But so I get these goats. I I find out that they're actually pretty intelligent, right? Goats have that goofy look because of the way their eyes are positioned. They look like they're just totally stupid, right? They look like the sloth on Ice Age is what they got. Yeah. They have this stupid look on their face, but they're actually crazy smart. In fact, they're just smart enough to be really aggravating, right? And I made panniers. I got some cheap backpacks and sewed it up to where I could make these panniers that would stay on them. And I, you know, kind of trained about filling their packs full of corn. We'd go over to back 40 and feed the deer. And it's like, hey, this is going to work out. I've got this figured out. So when it came time to go hunt.
Do you have more than one goat?
I had two.
Two goats and,
In this wagon train. But when it got time to go, it's like, you know, I think I can get by with one. And the one that was the smartest that, you know, didn't get bound up in the same trees over and over. I was like, I'm going to take this one out there. We're going to have a maiden voyage. I found out about Kansas City that this might be a problem because in all of our training, one of the things I hadn't anticipated was whether the animals could travel, right? And so by the time I got to Kansas City, I realized that the goat was motion sick. And by the time I got out west, the goat was so sick, I ended up boarding it at a veterinary and still backpacking it on your own, which is, you know, the whole idea is oftentimes you can carry your own champion, but if you kill something, then it's getting it out, right? Because when you're bow hunting, it's generally warm and meat goes bad pretty quickly. And it was in an attempt to maybe make you know, some of these remote spots a little more accessible. But anyway, in retrospect, I wish I had gone and found some Basque sheep herder up there and said, hey, this is what's for dinner is what I should have done because it wasn't inexpensive to board the goat, right? But
I just want to know what the vet said when you said, here, I'm from Indiana and I've got a goat that's car sick.
You know, I don't really remember I think the vet might have laughed at me, but what was probably more, you know, you can't make this up. What was probably more sobering was when I got there, it's like, well, you're going in regardless, right? So I've got this sick goat. I've got him loaded up real light. I'm thinking, you know, even if he can't carry anything in, if he can just carry stuff out, I get a short way down the trail and I can tell it's not going to work, right? He's wanting to lay down on me because he's dehydrated. And it's like, well, you know, the scours are going to follow. And and about that time, here comes this pack train out. Or pack train in.
You got your goat.
And I've got my pack goat. And here's this pack train of mules, which tells you, you know, what kind of spot I'm in, right? It's the West Elk Wilderness. It's one of the larger wilderness areas. And back then, I was avid. I was, if it's remote, I want to be there. Turns out that the guy, you know, he sees I've got this pack goat. And he's like, where are you from? And I told him. And he laughs. And it turns out that it's Wayne Carlton of Carlton's Calls, right? This guy was an icon of early elk calling, right? And so here's like this, elk hunting celebrity.
Yeah, this idol of yours.
Yeah, this elk hunting celebrity. And I ran into him on a pack trail. And he goes, you know, go tie your goat up. And he said, heck, you can just go in and hunt with us, right? So he actually gave, because they were so impressed that this guy's in the middle of this wilderness area. Anyway. The goat. Like I said, you can't
Did
make
you see
this
anybody up. Else with goats out there?
Actually, there's lots of folks that use llamas.
Really?
Yeah, it's a thing, right?
Okay.
People do use goats, llamas, smaller animals, because you don't have to have a trailer and you know, horses.
Did not know that.
Yeah, and the other cool thing is, you know, if it would have worked, if I'd had them travel worthy, you know, a coffee can of grain will keep a goat for a week if they have something grazed on.
Sure.
You've got water, right? And so anyway, yeah, that was a failed DIY attempt.
That's awesome.
And so, you know, then I started training on Donna, right? So almost.
Oh, my God.
So it'll be our 40th this year. I was thinking, man, it seems like a long time since I've been able to go on a backpack, you know, backcountry hunt. And I got to thinking, you know, 5 years
Donna
ago.
Donna weighs about 90 pounds.
Yeah. No, I can't use Donna as a pack animal. But I think I've told you before, about every five-year anniversary, we go somewhere.
Take Sal with you. I mean, he's an ex-Marine. He knows how to ruck a pack.
Yeah.
I think he would make a pretty good pack meal.
I'll bring a ranger.
A good hunting partner.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I'll bring a ranger.
Yeah. So.
Well, I don't know. Top that, Jeff.
No, I'm not even going to try to top that. That's, you know, I was, you know, I just looked at this a little bit ago and I'm like, I can't think of a weird DIY, but, you know, my, I can tell you a failure, and that is me trying to finish drywall. That doesn't work. So it's, you know, there's some things you need to hire the professionals.
That's true.
Like professional pack animals.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. When it comes to drywall, this is my experience. I can't leave it alone.
That's probably, that's, yeah.
Yeah, you gotta let it dry.
You keep yeah. piddling with it.
Yeah. You
those just, professionals just slap it on there and walk away.
Yeah.
Come back, sand it, walk away. And yep. put another skim coat on, walk away. Yep. Yeah. I'm sitting there piddling with it.
You're insatiable. Soon, yeah. You just can't leave it alone. You're yep. too compulsive for drywall.
But when I'm done, I want it to look just like the professionals, and I can't do that.
Well, my house is a testament to DIY drywall because I saved like, I think it was $3,000 to do all my own drywall, and it looks like it. If you go in my house and look around, you'd be like, what is that? But anyway, that was a, I don't know, as far as got a lot of little things, but probably the anything carpentry. And I always think it looks so simple to hang a door, and then 6 hours later, you know, I could have had a guy come over for $100 and put it in or something.
Sure. But
yeah, anything carpentry. Downstairs, I had the good idea that I was going to put barn siding in my downstairs living room. And after tried to drive a nail in old barn siding, you know what that's like. That's like iron. And so I had to get some drill bits to get starter holes and broke all the drill bits. And because I went to, and in Salem, Indiana, there's not that many places where you can go buy stuff. I mean, it's usually half a day to get there. And but so I was breaking the drill bits, and then I was like, well, I'll just get concrete nails. And so I just bend those over and eventually got it done. But it was a long project.
Yep.
Not a carpenter.
Me either.
Yep. All right. Well, Glenn, that's a good story about the goat pack animal.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go home and look this up to see if it is a thing. I don't
it's
know.
It's a thing. I'm telling you, it's a thing. Okay. I was a pioneer. You know, a failed pioneer, but I was a pioneer in that.
The guy that came out on top was the guy that sold you the goats.
Well, actually, I think they were donated, right?
Oh, really?
Well, so
loaner goats.
Yeah. So Jerry, you know, he sells them for 4-H projects. When people get done with the 4-H, you know, they don't really want to see them slaughtered. I think it's they really just don't want to know, right?
Yeah.
And so they ask Jerry if he'll take them back, and he takes them back. And, of course, you know.
Their fate's determined.
Yeah, their fate is determined. And
we just ruined it now. On the
Yeah. And back then, you know, goat wasn't so popular, right? We didn't have the, you know.
The ethnic markets for it.
Yeah, that's probably the best way to put it. But, yeah, we didn't have as many folks that ate goat at that time. And, but yeah, it actually worked pretty good. Don actually got pretty attached to him, right?
And then he hauled it off.
You know, when I said they were smart, you know, if you take a horse with panniers on. I don't know if
they're smart, but they have a personality.
Well, no, I actually think they're fairly intelligent. Because if you take a horse with a set of panniers on it and you lead them into a bunch of trees and they get bound up in the trees, right? And it's too narrow to pass. You can back a horse out, turn them loose, and they'll go right back and get hung up in the same trees, right? But you get a goat hung up in the trees, right? There's saplings that are too close together for them to get through with their panniers. And you back them out, they'll go right around it. So there's, you know, in my mind, I think they're actually fairly intelligent. But then again, the smarter something is, like a mule, is a lot more aggravating, right?
Yeah.
You know, on the few times when I was younger that we'd go into the backcountry on horses or mules, it was always funny. When it came time to pick camp up, right? Or if it went time to catch horses, you know, it was always easy to fool the horses, right? They go out and rattle buckets and, you know, lead them to believe they're going to get fed, even with piles of gear around, right? And the horses, they just come, you know, they just come wandering right on in. The mules kind of stand out there like, no, I've seen this trick before. I'm not coming in. They're going to load me down. I think I'll just sit out here and eat grass, right? And anyway, probably too colorful for this one.
That's funny.
Yeah, I guess we probably ought to get back on topic.
Yeah, we ought to do our podcast. We got Well, Glenn, tell us about the grower meetings. What's been your theme? And been very well received. I think we've done six of them so far. We got one tomorrow at Bogstown.
Yep.
So tell us about your theme and kind of the topics that you've been going through.
Sure. Well, the theme is surviving or thriving in 2025, right? That's the theme. And it's really obviously not about surviving. It's really about trying to change the focus that growers have right now from, hey, the markets are depressed. How are we going to cash flow this thing? It's really about changing their focus into how do we be successful, right? Because we really have no control over marketing. You know, the grain markets are going to do what the grain markets are going to do. but we do have we do have sovereignty over what we focus on, right? And there's really six things. If you think about it, there's really six things that if you get right, you'll about always have a successful crop, right? If we have a 2012, then guess what? We're all collecting crop insurance. But if we have something other than 2012, the guys that focus on getting a crop that really intentionally focus on yield will almost always come out on top, right?
Because, but break it up into those six things.
That's right.
And you increase your percentages are
sure. Your wins will go up. If you think about, I mean, here's the blocks, right? The things you have to get right is you have to pick, you know, we're all going to plant seed. You're going to buy seed. So regardless of what the cost is, you know, buy the best seed and position it in the best way to win. Right. That's number one. Number two is around weed control. Right. You can't raise big crops with a big mess of weeds. Right. And you're probably not, even if it doesn't hurt yield, if you leave a big mess behind, guess what? That means your crop protection bill the following year is going to be more expensive. Right. Yep. So that's another prerequisite. Soil fertility. Do we want to build up in a market where, you know, phosphorus is kind of high and potassium is going up? You know, last 2 months, you pointed out that that we've had a pretty big increase in potassium. I think 17%, not you jacking up the price 17%. I'm saying that the yes. manufacturers, right? What yep. comes into NOLA is 17% higher than it was 2 months ago when corn started to, started to rally a little bit. So, you know, that's kind of the bottom tier. The next tier is around, which most farmers are good about planting excellence, right? They're one extreme or the other. They either are so compulsive that everything has to be perfect around planting, which is the way it should probably be. But you can also be paralyzed by trying to make things too perfect, right? If you miss that first window, trying to have absolute perfect planting excellence because you're still fooling around with the planter, trying to get some other attachment, right, that's going to add four to five bushels, right? I'm being facetious mm-hmm. there, right? Because you could take a brand new planter and spend as much as the planter cost on putting attachments onto a brand new planter, right? So it's around planting excellence, which really isn't just planting. It's about planting. It's about using technology like PGRs. It's about getting your starter fertilizer. It's about population, plant spacing variability. It's all those things around planting excellence. And then it shifts. The last two blocks are really about in season, right? It's around in-season management of nutrition and fungicides, right? To finish up and try not to lose any of that yield that we've gathered up through the season, right? And so those six things are really key. And I have growers push back, and I have growers that are a little reluctant to obligate. That's one of the things that we're hopefully going to do this week is get growers that have not made some of those decisions, right? And it doesn't have to be like you have to make all the decisions the same day, but each decision is a bifurcation in the path, right? First decision they maybe made was back in October. Hey, we're gonna plant corn and soybeans next year. Maybe we ought to get some ordered. And then the next decision is, are we going to keep the same rotation, or are we going to go heavier corn because corn looks a little more attractive? And then once you've got that done, well, gee, if I'm going to plant a bunch of corn, don't you think maybe we ought to have some nitrogen source, or maybe we ought to have some crop protection products in, you know, sitting over in the side? And yet we've got growers that have everything done, and we have a higher percentage of growers than probably ever before that have not finalized their needs. And I would point out that 11 months ago today, we were in the field going hot and heavy. Well, most people were in the field. I was actually in Argentina vacationing, and that was a mistake. But yeah, the last week of March, if you remember the last 2 weeks of March last year, it was dry. You could do any kind of tillage work you wanted to do. You could do excavation work. There were guys actually planting. There was a lot of burn down was done. And so, you know, yeah, I know it's a late Easter, but we're a month away from when we could be rocking and rolling. And yet there's guys that don't really have their fertility programs buttoned down. They maybe have spoken for seed, but they don't really have it at the granular level, right? They, you know, full disclosure, right? I do fall, you know, on my own farm, I do fall P&K just so that I'm not tempted to spend that money someplace that's less appropriate, right? I want to reinvest in things that make you money. It's really easy to get bound up in pain. You know, Jeff has got me lined up. I've got my solution. You know, I've got my nitrogen needs caught up. I've got my seed ordered. But I got to thinking on crop protection products, you know, I still don't have my group 15, my group 27s. You know, I don't have enough of those to carry me over into the next year. So I really need to get those buttoned up. And then, you know, on the way here, I thought, you know, I don't have enough fungicide for both passes. You know, I've got my kind of mid-tier stuff kind of cashed up for next year.
You should have told us we just ran out. Sorry, Glenn.
Yeah, thank you. But you know, one of the things I'd really encourage growers to do is think about, you know, when it right now, your LOC or your budget for crop protection products is still pretty full, right? And I think maybe the reason why there's a lag is not because growers are indecisive. It's maybe because we just got settled up from a really tough year and we don't really want to start spending our nest egg or putting money on our LOC, right? I think there's a reluctance there. You know, we're still licking our wounds from last year and now you're wanting to belly back up. But when it comes to crop protection, specifically fungicides, you know, we tend to make that decision in season. And it's the easiest thing in the world to talk yourself out of because it comes at a time of the year when growers are the least cash rich of the entire season, right? Midsummer, late summer, that's when you've made most all the investment.
You've outlaid everything.
Absolutely. And yes, if the environment is really good and it's obvious that I've got a great hand, you know, we're playing Texas Hold'em and I've got a great hand, man, they'll spend the money regardless. But if it turns off dry, like it has the previous four Junes, oftentimes your instinct is, hey, maybe, you know, there's not that much pathogen pressure out there. Maybe I'll just get by with one pass instead of two passes. That's where if you already have it in the stable, right? If you've already got the chemistry in the warehouse, it's much easier to do the right thing agronomically, right? And the right thing agronomically is to take advantage, right? Get your timings right, regardless of the weather, right? Get your timings right and make sure that you, you know, make a first pass to kind of keep those pathogens that start early and work their way up the plant, keep them at bay, and then delay that second pass into a top-tier product that can get you to physiological maturity with little or no yield loss. Again, it all stems back to making the right decisions today, right? And if you start out today looking down a path of, hey, I think maybe I can save a few pesos here and add that to my bottom line, that hardly ever works out, right? Your potential in agriculture is nearly always better to make money than it is to save money because, one, those inputs, right? When I showed you that pie chart of you know, all the things that go into a cash flow, right? Things like CPP, seed, crop nutrition, CN, you know, those things aren't like 80% of the crop, right? They're only like 50%. 15, yeah. 50% of the crop, right? And if you take rent, which is typically, you know, a third or you know, somewhere just short of a third, and those variable costs that we all hate to give up, right? Operational costs, equipment, fuel, labor. When you take those things, and we put a real number on those operational costs, that was muted in those meetings, right? I had it down as like 15%. That's almost nonsensical. We all spend way more than that in this country, right? So it's fully 50% is in things that maybe don't have that big of impact on yield, right? And the things that we are tempted oftentimes because they are less sexy, right? It's pretty sexy if you get a new tractor or you get a new combine or you get a new planter, right? Those things are all, you know, the neighbors can see those. The neighbor can't see that you're taking care of P&K. And the neighbor can't see that you made that original application of fungicide, right? Because there's probably not much pathogen pressure there. But when stress is on and you've used fungicides as a stress mitigation tool, then down the road, guess what? at the end of the day, the number of trucks that come off of a particular acre is probably going to be enhanced by those products. So,
you know, Glenn, I think there's a lot to that. I mean, I've heard your talk now throughout the meetings, and I've thought about, you know, as those decision times for making those investments, and it's the things that you can see and feel, and you know you got a tractor, you
right.
know.
That's right.
You can see it. I mean, you ride in it, you enjoy it, you get it. And our local school system, we got to replace the septic system. It's going to be $1 million. Nobody's going to know
right.
that there's $1 million to help move the sewage waste. The waste, right?
Exactly.
That is not sexy, and it doesn't show up. You know, a new sports complex would, everybody can see that, or, you know, a new volleyball court or something. And same thing with the farmers. I mean, all of us, if you had to invest in a new heating and air or a new roof or something like that, that's sure. But how do we break that kind of that mindset? You joke half joking, say, you know, about your, how you commit yourself to fertilizer. Yep, yep. How do we get all of us in a plan to get that type of success or these 6 points? I mean, yeah. going through these best seed, weed control, soil fertility, they sound like pretty foundational.
You know, I've got a, and this, I'll tell this story and I think you can elaborate on it. You're talking about basically putting that plan together. The had a grower yesterday, talks to his salesman, that account manager comes into my office and says, "Hey, guy needs a little over 100 tons of ammonium sulfate." I said, "That's funny. I thought he already bought that." Well, says he needs another 100 tons.
Right.
The difference from what he bought the first round to what he's going to buy now is $75 a ton higher.
Right.
But I didn't know he was going to need it back then. And we kind of go through our plan. We buy what we think we need. Well, now I've got to go back into the market and buy more. And the market's gone up $75.
Right.
So it's 100. So let's just say it's 100. $7,500. You know, in the size and scale of everything, that's not gonna kill him. But those little $7,500 pieces that you can, the more of those you can pick up, and if he had just kind of planned, I didn't really need him to prepay it. I just need him to say, "Hey, I need it." We'd have bought it when the market was cheaper. We'd have had it there for him. But now we got to go back in. We got to pay a higher price. And so those little things, and it's just plan. Let your account manager know. Let us build a forecast so we can get that product when the best time to buy it is, and save them some money. So.
Yeah. Yep.
That's just one real world example that walked in my office yesterday.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we see that with seed lot, right? The it does seem kind of ridiculous. The price of seed corn, right? It seems a little ridiculous at first, right? But when you consider all the technology that went into creating this this appreciation that we're seeing, right? I mean, now that we're in the biotech age, right? It was one thing. Seed probably wasn't very expensive, right? It basically was the cost of grain whenever it was open pollinated. We went to double cross, right? They suddenly were charging $20 a bag. We went to single cross hybrids. During that period, it probably went from $40 a bag to, you know, $100. And then we got in the biotech age and all of these technologies that basically accelerate the selection process, right? Whether that's marker-assisted breeding, whether that's chips, that's really what it's about. It's about accelerating the genetic gain. And you know, it seems counterintuitive to spend that kind of money on seed, and yet there's probably no other single input that's put more bushels towards our bottom line than what has seed.
Consistently.
Yeah, consistently, right? I mean, what is the probability, right? I'm not a mathematician, but what is the probability that if we didn't have genetic gain, that the last 5 years would have been our if not five of our best years, four of our five best years ever, of production, right? There's no other way you can explain that, right? Other than it's come through genetic gain. Are we managing better? Yes. But even the guys that aren't managing significantly different are still raising their best crops ever. Could it be the climate? We've just got in a trend where we've got a better climate. Yeah, maybe. But you know what? It is significantly changed. When we have a good, the part of the county that gets the extra rain, they're not going from 200 to 230. They're going from 240 to 280 or 300, right? And so what that speaks to is, well, how much influence should price have on our decision on seed? Well, probably not much at all, right? I mean, and in fact, within a particular brand, the difference between the latest and greatest releases and stuff that's 4 or 5 years old is oftentimes less than $10 a unit. Well, you divide that by, 2.5 acres per unit, that equates to less than a bushel of corn, right? It really doesn't equate at all. So really, you need to just put anything to do with pricing on seed, you should just put that out of your mind, and all your focus should be on how can I get my hands on the newest, best seed, and where can I find information to position it better, right? It's the same deal on crop protection, right? When I say crop protection, I'm talking about even just herbicides, right? We know that early season weed control is how you support high yields, right? You know, you can have some stuff in a crop come up later, right? When you go in, you're over in Davies County, those guys are outstanding cooperators and they've got a great soil resource and they do a pretty good job of getting their giant ragweed. But you get later in the season, as the season gets longer in the tooth and you're driving around the outside edge, what do you see?
Oh yeah, they're sticking up everywhere.
Yeah, you got morning glories, that basically go from the road ditch four rows out into the crop, right? And so that's probably not economic, but
cosmetically, it's terrible.
Cosmetically, it looks terrible, right? And so can you save a little money by going from branded stuff off to private label or from private label to generic? Absolutely. But what happens if you have a failure, right? And oftentimes with the generics comes a lower level of support. And I just know this, right? We oftentimes spend a lot of focus on, well, did we get acceptable control this year? Yeah, you might have, but it takes very little water hemp, for example, to escape at the end of the year to make an absolute disaster the next year, right? And so, whether you pay me now or you pay me later, typically the most successful growers are those that do everything possible to not just influence this year's crop, but to make sure next year they don't have a problem either. And it might be so simple as, maybe we're already using metribuzin and Zidua, right? Peroxysulfone or metribuzin and S-metolachlor. But how about adding a group 14, add another effective mode of action, maybe not a post-emerge 14, but a pre-emerge 14, whether that's safafenacil or fludioxanil or safafenacil, sulfentrazone, flumioxazin, or, these would be brands. Sorry, I'm getting wound up here. Safafenacil would be like the sharpened brands, and flumioxazone would be like the Valor Fierce brands, and sulfentrazone would be Spartan or the Authority Sonic brands, right? Broadax brands. Yep. There's another mode of action that does it mean that you can go from two post passes to one post pass? Maybe, but it may be the difference between having, 3 million seeds per acre to thin out next year versus 25 billion seeds per acre, right? When because you got to realize these weeds are shedding, a quarter million seeds per plant. So right. How many of those do you have to have in to make a heck of a mess?
Not many.
Not very many. And so, again, I'm not saying that that you have to go in there with four modes of action. You have to spend $200 an acre. But you certainly need to have early season weed control. And then you need to rely on your consultant to help you navigate, because it's rare to find a grower that has, a wide enough view of all the different options, right? To a grower, he gets used to maybe this brand, right? And maybe there's rewards to make you stay in that brand, and you're not really exposed to maybe other crop protection products that could work. But your account rep, your account, I hate to even call them account reps, because these ladies and gentlemen are great agronomists, right? We almost should call them account agronomists, but they're good with business too. And what they have is a little wider view, right? They're not just dealing with your giant ragweed. They've got guys down the road that have problems with velvet leaf now, and we all have trouble with water hemp. And maybe they have experience with crop protection products that you haven't necessarily painted with in your palette. Right.
Well, they've got the experience across thousands of acres of seeing all these different scenarios where you're limited to, you know, your farm and what's happened there in the past. So, and when you put those two things together, that's a pretty good winning team.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So yeah, having a good consultant, that's really key. You know, we talked in these meetings about soil fertility. And again, I'm not convinced this is a great time to do a lot of building, right? Because P and K are relatively expensive. But you can't do without nitrogen, right? And you shouldn't ever really skip on P and K, right? And I started to say this earlier. One of the things that our growers really need to guard against is they do need to remember, and we've talked about this numerous times on this podcast, about this perception that there's a bunch of native fertility in the soil that all you have to do is unlock, right? If a consultant or a salesperson comes to your farm and says, hey, you don't need to put any of this on, talking about mineral nutrition, whether that's phosphorus, potassium, whatever, because we have a organism, whether that's a chelating or something. Well, whether it's a living organism, whether it's a bacteria, a fungi, a plant growth regulator, a biostimulant, if they ever start talking about replacing mineral nutrition, you absolutely run, right? Just run from those folks. That's where I really hope that our growers are putting kind of that, you know, in Sunday school, they talk about putting on that breastplate of faith, right? The armor of God. I'm hoping our growers are putting that armor on, because we don't raise crops in a closed system, right? This isn't a forest ecosystem where, you know, the crop gets to full maturity and we let it just melt down and go back into the earth. That's not what we're doing. We're raising a great big crop. I mean, huge crops, which pull a huge amount of mineral nutrition out of the ground, which we put there via mines in Florida or Canada.
And then we load it on a semi in the form of corn and haul it away from your property. Yeah,
exactly. And does that mineral nutrition go back to the ground? Absolutely. But it doesn't go back to the ground here unless the livestock is fed here and you are the recipient of the waste. It goes into the ground in South Carolina or outside of a feedlot in Colorado or maybe even goes to Europe as DDGs and then gets pooped out into some Dutchman's field, right? It's not an open system, and people that represent their products as though, hey,
yeah, it's not a closed system.
Did I say you said
open?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. It's not a closed system. It's an open system. Right. And ultimately, I hope our growers, and I'm sure most of our growers are that sophisticated, but you know, when times get lean, then those types of remedies look a lot more attractive. So that's, I've kind of babbled on here.
No, but you're right though. I mean, that's what a lot of times we want to hear.
Yeah, it is what growers want to hear. But the meetings have been great. I'll tell you
what's the best question you've had?
Man, I have had two questions that literally gave me faith that the audience is conscious, right? Because sometimes I look at across an audience and it kind of hurts my feelings as an agronomist, because you know how I am. I don't really like doing this.
Are you passionate? Is that what you're trying to say?
Well, or maybe compulsive is probably more accurate than passionate. But I do get passionate about, you know, and this isn't proprietary to me, right? Jason Roth, a peer of mine up north that works for Keystone, we've had this conversation several times. That when we start talking about a particular topic, we love to go into the nitty gritty, into the minutia of detail, right? And it really kind of hurts my feelings to see the growers kind of respond to us skipping across, you know, taking a more shallow view of all these individual disciplines of agronomy and not going very deep, right? That seems like that's what the audience really wants. And yet that's not really what I want to provide, right? I want to give them all the detail. And so
they don't want the labor pains. They just want to see the baby.
Exactly. That's right. They don't really want to know how to build the clock. They only want to know what time it is. Yeah. But your question is really profound. I had a young man ask, so we were showing, we were talking about potassium, and I think I've shown this metadata that SureTech put together where basically it shows, when I say metadata, it's not, they didn't have a trial that tried to produce just this data. They are taking soil samples from all over the state, and then they take that they take that composite of data and combine it to say, hey, is there a trend? And what you'll notice is when Tri-State started ratcheting down maintenance or removal, when they started ratcheting that number down back in the early millennium, you saw in the state of Indiana, you saw potassium levels go down at a pretty steep angle. And that particular graph is over a block of color that represents the Tri-State's nutrient sufficiency level. And the question was, well, hey, if the maintenance numbers are wrong, and that's why the curve starts to crash, why does it go down and level out, right? If we're not putting enough on to cover maintenance, then why would the thing start to level out? It seems like it should just continue to crash. And I was so taken back because that is not intuitive, right? And yet I had the answer because I had thought about it before. What transpires is when you're in the sufficiency range and you're not putting enough on maintenance-wise because the numbers are maybe a little light, right? 0.2 is probably, we probably remove more than 0.2 pounds of potassium when we have an actively growing crop, right? But the reason why it flattens out when we get to the bottom of the sufficiency range really speaks to the fact that when we get at the low end of the sufficiency range, we start to do what in our recommendations? We start to add buildup to get you back into the sufficiency range. Well, we got to the bottom of the sufficiency range. We start making buildup recommendations, and we don't really build because we're really using it up in maintenance, right? Because we're raising these great big crops. And so I was absolutely flabbergasted that this young man, identified that. Didn't know why, but it's probably the single best question I've had. I had a good one yesterday. I think... it's encouraging when you're an agronomist, when you're a technical guy, that you, when you see an audience that stays fully engaged the entire time, and when they have questions, that tells you that you're probably, it may not be the way you want to cover the topics, right? I might want to go into herbicide modes of action and talk about group numbers and protoperfringence and oxidase and how that kills plants.
I still think you make those names up.
I'm starting to become more conscious that that's not necessarily what our growers want, right? They would rather have a higher level. Right? Maybe a little higher level.
Well, I know at Greensburg, whenever you pointed to the screen and said, here is the deal. If you take this away, this is the, and it was about the soybean leaf. And pointing out that most of the nutrition or the pod field comes from that leaf, the trifoliates there to that node. And 90 growers sat up straighter in their seats.
Sure.
And it's like almost like the teacher is giving them the answer to the quiz, right? This will be on the quiz tomorrow. Write this down.
Absolutely. Well, I know our growers are used to hearing me say this, right? And yet, again, it's probably the most profound thing that we've learned about soybeans. And we've known it since the 90s, or I guess the information's been collected back in the 90s. But it's how you... oftentimes it's not whether you have the information, it's whether you can implement it, right? It's about implementation. And I don't think even though we've known that the photosynthate that fills the pod at any given node comes not exclusively, but the majority of it comes from the trifoliate attached at that node, right? Which means that if you have pods at the bottom part of the plant and there's no actively photosynthesizing trifoliates attached at that node, those pods are not going to make it, right? And so we may have known that, but we didn't really, I don't think we knew how to implement that, right? And so when these contest winners are trying to shorten plants up and they're using sub-optimal densities of plants, right? And yet the yields are going up when you would, when it's totally counterintuitive, right? You think low, you know, fewer plants. Well, now I've got to make even more nodes and I have to get more pods per node to make up for the lack of plants. It doesn't work that way. It's totally counterintuitive. And until you reconcile that in your mind, you're probably not going to manage soybeans correctly, right? And we know that the key oftentimes to increasing yield, not just protecting plants, but increasing yield is often increasing nutrition, right? It's about making the factory produce more photosynthate. And it's getting that tooling, whether that's nitrogen or potassium or, sulfur. It's about getting more tooling in there so that the factory runs more efficiently, right? But again, if the factory is the wrong size, it doesn't do you any good, right? You can have this great big factory that it's almost like, you know, to make this political, right? It's almost like the federal government, right? Eventually it gets so big and so bloated that it now is the largest consumer of its own.
Of itself,
right? And that's what you get with great big soybeans, right? You get a great big soybean plant. And this has been totally misrepresented by physiologists, right? You know, one of the brightest guys that I ever listened to around nutrition was Tim Eirich, right? And Tim works for Helm now. And I don't keep up with Tim much, but I do know he works for Helm and I know he's still passionate about plant nutrition. But Tim would always make the comment that soybeans are a source-based crop, not a sink-based crop, right? So corn is a sink-based crop. In other words, if you make a bigger sink, if you put more plants out there and you have more ears, you almost always yield more because you've created a bigger sink. And yet they've always referred to soybeans as like a source-based crop. Typically, the bigger and more robust you make soybeans, then the more likely they're going to yield. And you know what? Tim is exactly right. If you're in Minnesota, where a big soybean crop might be, you know, a little better than knee high, right? But when you get in the South, where we raise, you know, we have a larger, longer growing season, we have more uniform day length, and we raise fuller season varieties that potentially have more nodes to start with, that doesn't really equate, right? When we raise really big, robust crops because we have too high a density. You know, growers love to hear me say, you'll have the biggest, most beautiful, robust 50 bushel beans you'll ever cut. Right. And that's exactly
come right. All the way up your shoulders.
Yeah. You know, this is how we finish the meetings, by the way, is talking about soybean production and how, and what you can do. And by the way, for listeners out there, you know, March we'll have some rough weather. And if we get some stormy weather in March, please get with your account rep and say, hey, is there any way we could have if you're interested, say, is there any way we can have an appointment with Glenn to just talk about high yield soybean management? And we'll talk about density and we'll talk about variety selection and we'll talk about all the components it takes to raise high yield soybeans. And sometimes it's totally counterintuitive. Right. You know, take Arkansas, where they've done a pretty good job of documenting contest winners, right? Because they have a lot of guys that have raised 100 bushel soybeans. This seems counterintuitive from the Midwest, or certainly the upper Midwest, that the row width, right, is indirectly proportional, right? Typically you expect as row width increases, right, as you go into wider rows, the yield goes down. And that's the way it is in the majority of the Corn Belt. But when you get in the Southern Corn Belt where we're at and you get into the Mid-South, it is almost backward, right? It is very difficult to raise exceptional soybeans in narrow rows because you tend to have too much density, right? And you get too much density. You've seen this, Jeff, when you're swimming through soybeans in the summertime and they have these great big long 24, 28-inch long petioles with three little leaflets. Right? Those are never your best beans, right? Those are almost really common. And why are they really common? Because the density was too high, the row width was too narrow, and what you did was you effectively starved all of the lower nodes of light, right? Where when you take these guys from Arkansas, I, you know, when you look at the metrics, there will be one or two or three guys that are in 7.5 or 15-inch rows. The vast majority of the guys that are raising in excess of 100 bushel soybeans, you know, they're doing it consistently, are doing it in 30s and 38-inch twin rows or 40-inch twin rows, right? They're doing it in these wider row configurations. And it's and the secret is not about wide rows. The secret is about light interception, right? So if you could get them evenly distributed in 15-inch rows, right, and end up with a final stand that was evenly, I mean, what do you suppose, if you have two beans per foot, Jeff, right? If you have two beans per foot, do you think you can harvest, you know, all the light or nearly all the light that would hit that acre if you had
two beans? This is probably a loaded question.
It is. I'm trying to get where
yeah,
I'm going.
Yeah,
with,
Jeff. What
yeah,
do you think?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I know you're kind of a math whiz. Yes or no. Well, you're a fertilizer guy and you're a math whiz. But right, we all know there's 43,560 square feet in an acre. If you had two beans per foot, that's just a little over 80,000. And I assure you that is plenty of stand to get maximum yield. And in fact, think if you just had one soybean per foot, think how robust a soybean plant gets when you give it a little bit of light. This is one of the reasons why growers don't believe that soybeans respond to management. It's because soybeans are so adaptable. They're so plastic, if you will, that they tend to overcompensate for voids. And so what is the right, you know, what is the right plant density? We've got plenty of data out there from university sources that actually are leading us in some cases down the wrong path, right? If it's a 50 bushel yield environment, then I assure you that probably having more plants is going to yield, you know, a higher dividend. But when you get into really high yield environments, it can sometimes go just the opposite. Mm. In fact, I've seen some pretty decent data around variable rate systems in soybeans. And it's the opposite of corn, right? When you use variable rate in corn, typically you upplant the good spots of the field. And when you get to the perimeter of the field and the places that have lower cropping potential, you do what? You reduce the population. You reduce the seeding rate. Soybeans respond in the opposite fashion. When you're in the common parts of the field, typically we overpopulate those to make sure we have weed control, make sure we are collecting, we get enough vegetative growth to cover the ground, collect as much sunlight as we can. So it is about collecting solar radiation, but that often gets exaggerated too. And we'll come back to that. But it's really about thinning those better parts of the field, because we're going to get plenty of vegetative growth to get canopy. And then what we really want to encourage is not more vegetative growth, not more plant height. We don't need more internode length. What we really want to encourage is the plant to invest in flowers and pods that it then keeps as opposed to upsizes, right?
But I remember back, you know, this is going back to the late 80s and through the 90s and stuff when I was, you know, as a chemical rep and being involved in Roundup Ready soybeans, it seemed like there was so much conflicting information out there. You know, the guys were going to, you know, down to 15, so, you know, go to 7-inch, we're running drills, population, and I want to say there were like 115,000, 120 some thousand plants. I mean, and then the next thing you know, it's like, well, this guy, he just went back to 30-inch row. I mean, you know, we want bush beans. We want, you know, it was just all over the board. It seemed like it was just every year there was, oh, you got to chase this trend, got to chase sure. this trend. I mean, so what you're saying is we finally have got some more information figured out.
We do. And you know, technology has changed too, Jeff. It's really not fair to say that, our grandfathers that were using untreated seed and were in modest yield environments, you know, 45, 50 bushel yield environments was a good crop. You know, it would be irresponsible us to cast doubt on our grandpas and say, hey, those guys, you know, they didn't have a clue what they were doing, right?
They did the best of what they had.
That's yeah. right. They were sowing, right? Seed was cheap. And when you overpopulated, you tended to maximize yields, right? Because the plants were more modest. And they were sowing 180 to 220,000 plants.
Yeah, I was going to say, I couldn't remember. I knew it was a big number.
It was huge numbers. But the mortality was crazy, right? You sowed 180,000 to ensure that you maybe got 150 or 120, right? One of the things that's really changed that's made it so much easier for growers today is seed treatments, right? And you've heard me say that I remember LBST, right? Life before seed treatments, because we replanted soybeans all the time.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
And we always had these crazy substandard stands, right? You know, the worst thing that can happen to you is not to go into, you know, the worst thing that can happen to you as a grower is not to, you know, sow 130,000 plants and end up with 80,000 plants evenly distributed. The worst thing that can happen is you plant 130,000 plants and you end up with 80,000 plants that have big gaps and voids all over them.
Yeah.
That's where you have to go back and replant. And so if you look at the influence that seed treatments have had on production, it's not really about just controlling the critters or the pathogens increasing yield. It's the seed treatment has allowed us to pull our seeding rates back with the confidence that we'll get an evenly distributed stand. And that's what's had the biggest impact on yield, is that we now can sow a more modest seeding rate, which allows for more light infiltration, which then allows us to get more pods deeper into the canopy. And, you know, and by the way, if they're thinner, do they get taller or shorter? They stay shorter.
Short.
And if they're shorter, then that affords you to be able to feed them more aggressively, right? Because if you feed 160,000 plants aggressively, you don't have to worry about having the biggest, most robust plants, because by the time you get to harvesting them, they're going to be on the ground and it's going to be a mess, right? And so, you know, these are the insights that I love to share with growers. And, we got some personal experience, right? When I first started talking about high-yield soybeans, I was a voyeur, right? I was basically using experience from other growers alone and trying to help weed out what is real and what is, what is real and what is foo-foo dust, right? And that's kind of what we run into following contest winners, right? Contest winners, there's a lot of things we could learn from contest winners. Unfortunately, the things that probably make the biggest impact, they probably guard, right? Because that's what differentiates them. And then oftentimes what we get as the solution from contest winners are the things that they get compensated for, right? Remember those guys?
Put that in there.
Yeah. Those guys are like NASCAR drivers. They got patches all over their flight suit, right?
Yep.
So anyway, boy, we've covered a lot of ground.
I tell you, one of the takeaways, though, is that if we do have time and get with your account manager, set up a time to just come in and visit a little bit about high-yield soybeans, because the last 2 points were in season. Now, those Absolutely. Are things that you can do either with fungicides or with nutritionals, and to make an impact on this year. So,
absolutely.
All right, Jeff, do you have anything else?
No, I think so. We covered a lot of ground. That was good. Now you get your one-on-one with the doctor over here. So that, you know, call for that appointment.
That's right.
There you go.
Well, Glenn, thanks a lot. And
my
we
pleasure.
Appreciate you all tuning in. That's another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. Thank you all very much.